So I said, how do you get a divining rod? And he said, people have fancied that if they cut a branch of hazel on Midsummer Eve, it would serve them as a divining rod to discover treasures and water. This belief has existed in Moravia, Mecklenburg, and apparently in Scotland. In the Mark of Brandenburg, they say that if you would procure the mystic wand, you must go to the hazel by night on Midsummer Eve, walking backwards. And when you have come to the bush, you must silently put your hands between your legs and cut a fork-shaped stick. That stick will be the divining rod, and, as such, will detect treasures buried in the ground. If you have any doubt as to the quality of the wand, you have only to hold it in water, for in that case, your true divining rod will squeak like a pig, but your spurious one will not. In Bavaria, they say that the divining rod should be cut from a hazel bush between 11 and 12 on St. John's night, and that by means of it you can discover not only veins of metal and underground springs, but also thieves and murderers and unknown ways. So I did exactly what he said. And by the time I straightened up, and turned around and held the divining rod in my hand, it had already started to rain.
Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. I'm Rachel Brown, and you just heard from Stephen Sexton with some excellent advice on divining rods. In this light-headed summer solstice episode, Ian Sansom talks to Aisling Clark about the supernatural, and Marcella Prince reads some poems.
Ash is here. Aisling Clark is here. Where have you been recently? You said you've been somewhere sunny, had you?
Or? Yeah, I was in Spain twice, and I was in Los Angeles twice.
Like
work stuff.
What was this? What's the current?
I'm always at something, but in Spain it was film festivals, so screenings, and then in LA it was hopefully stuff that's going
to
happen.
So you go into LA and then going to Spain is all off the back of the most recent film.
Well, my first feature film.
Oh, your first feature film. Let's refer to it as such.
Yes, my first feature film, which is called The Devil's Door, and it's just kind of come to the end of its festival run now. So for the past year, it premiered in May last year on the festival circuit, and then it came out in cinemas in the States in July, and so the whole past year has just been going to festivals, doing Q&As in cinemas from time to time, and just loads and loads of travelling.
And how does it all that work? I mean, to someone like me, this seems impossibly glamorous and fabulous, but how does it all actually, once you've done, take me through from the beginning to the point at which you're kind of, you know, it's released in cinemas in America.
Well, I mean, you make a film and what you want is for people to see it, you know? You just want other people to see it and ideally to respond to it. That's the same reason that you guys write, you know, Stephen does his poetry and you write your books.
Almost no one sees either Stephen's poetry or my book, I have to say. But
you make them for this imagined audience, and you hope that they exist. And so getting it out there at all was, and actually you don't know, that last day in the edit suite where you sign off on everything, you look at it one last time, the producers are there and you say, okay, well, there's no glaring mistakes anymore. We haven't misspelled someone's name in the credits. Everything has been signed off on. You don't know if anyone is ever going to want to see it and how many people will see it or how they're going to respond. And at that point, you've been in there for a long time. And the whole process from the beginning of the film, it's been a long time. And you just can't see the wood for the trees. So then when you get word that it's been picked up by a sales agent or a distributor and they're going to roll it out across America in cinemas. And
how does that bit happen then? So you've had to raise all the money, or your producer really?
Producer tends to be in control of the money side of things, which is good because I don't really have a head for financial stuff. And they sort out all the funding and everything like that. Then when the film is finished, they send it out to sales agents and distributors to see if one of them wants to take it on to sell.
Okay.
And then they'll either put it into a theatrical release, and nowadays it's video on demand, Amazon, Netflix, that kind of thing.
Right.
Or else just VOD. And then eventually your Blu-rays and DVDs and stuff. So right. they take charge of that side of it. And then you just, as a director, once you've signed off that last day, you're just told what to do. From then on, it's just, right, we've sold. I don't really get asked about the about that part of the process. They just come to me and say, Ashlyn, we've sold it to X sales agents. And they're taking it here, taking it there. Will you go to Spain for this film festival? Will you go over to New York for the premiere and the cinema there? It was for the public, like to, you know, do Q&A after and all that kind of thing. So you just go where you're told. So then it's a lot of traveling.
Yeah. And did you enjoy that bit? Did you enjoy that bit kind of, or are you kind of more someone who really wanted, do you really read, like a lot of writers, you know, talk to, or I suppose because you're a writer and a director, it's slightly different, but a lot of writers, you know, fundamentally you get the feeling they'd like to be in a little room by themselves, yeah. just with food brought into them occasionally, and that would be fine.
It is nice to do Q&As and hear what people think of it or what they have to say. The very first one that I ever did was pretty scary because you've no idea how they're going to respond to it, and they might hate it, you know. But I think I like that part of it. I like talking to people about it, and I like it is a horror film, so there's a very tight knit kind of horror community, and people are very loyal to the genre, and it's nice to kind of be part of that. But the traveling is sort of like, I mean, it sounds really nice, and my mother thinks it's really cool and all the rest of it. She's always like, "Oh, will you take me with you?" Right. But really, I mean, you're
and
going
do
to.
Do you? No.
I haven't. Oh, I did take her. I went to the Cannes Film Festival for sales stuff.
Right.
And I took her to that.
If you're going to take your mum anyway, you'd take her there, wouldn't
she
you?
She was very happy with that. Right. Yeah, she was hoping to see George Clooney. It didn't happen.
Oh, right. Okay. Next year.
Yes, of course. Yeah. But really, I mean, you're sent somewhere. A lot of the time, it's just kind of one night and you're in and out, or. It's, you're not really getting to, and all you, they pick you up at the airport. They arrange everything, pick you up at the airport. They take you to the hotel, then they take you to the screening, the Q&A, then they take you back to the hotel. And sometimes they've, usually they'll have organized interviews and dinners and stuff. So you don't, it's not like you go to, you can't even remember sometimes where I was or.
Right.
You know, what country that was. It all kind of becomes.
It's beginning to sound a bit like a horror film. It
can get lonely.
Can it? Yes.
I've started to bring my husband with me.
Right.
If I can, if he can make it just to. Because, I mean, that was a lot. I was flying 2-3 times a month for the past year.
Bloody hell. Were you?
Yeah.
Good grief.
I was away more than I was at home.
Right.
And I was over and back to America that much that the TSA were starting to be like, what are you doing?
Oh, okay. You know?
Like, this is a bit weird.
Right.
But yeah, so I bring him if I can.
But I suppose, presumably you were thinking to yourself, right, this is your kind of passport to, you know, who knows what comes off, you know, this. Is that how you're thinking of this? Because this was a massive breakthrough for you.
It's a huge deal to get your film out there and to get it distributed and to have, as someone who was always a film fan, I think the ideal is to go to the cinema by yourself. That's what I do during the day if possible.
It feels transgressive, doesn't it?
Is
that the appeal of that? Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And also it's quieter and, you know, right. there aren't other people there and you don't get people who are laughing and throwing popcorn and stuff.
It's, yeah, that's me. Yeah.
So to be able to go to a cinema that was showing my film, they showed it at some odd times. It was on at like 11:30 in the day in New York at one point. It was on at nighttime as well, but the daytime showing was like 11:30. And I just went in and bought some popcorn and sat there. That was nice, you know, to do that for your own film.
Yeah.
And it's nice to know that it's out there and people will see it and everything. But it's just what you have to do. You have to go on that tour to support the film and to get as much publicity for it as you can. And you just kind of owe it to the film, you know, I guess. And also contractually obliged to do so as well, which is the other thing.
Right.
But just do what you have to do.
This poem is called Weather Report, and it was overheard in a cafe in rural Minnesota, so that's why it sounds the way it does. Weather Report. Oh hey, I know. One day it's so hot you could fry an egg on the sidewalk, and the next it's really coming down in buckets. The river really is getting pretty high, but I gotta tell you though, the weather may be not so good for you, but my corn sure is happy.
So I think of you as a writer, but this is you as a in a completely different mode, isn't it? In a sense, but I mean, but you've done directing of other things before, haven't you?
Well, I mean, I studied film, and I've been making films since I was about 20.
Right. Did you go to film school? Did you?
Yeah. I studied film here at Queen's.
Right.
I couldn't go anywhere else because my son was very young.
Yeah.
So I went, but Queen's was, and it was brand new. They didn't have film up until the year before that point. And it was very academic. It was very much, you know, watching films.
Oh, was it? And film theory, was it?
Yes, that sort very of thing. Much. Right. But I think that was really useful. But I also had a Super 8 camera and I was making my own films at the time. I didn't have access to anything else, but I also like that format to shoot in. And I did music videos and visuals for nightclubs and stuff like that. I did a lot of, I was very much more, I suppose you would call it avant-garde, but really it was, I didn't have the confidence to, probably.
Because sometimes there's a fine line between the two.
Yeah. But I was experimenting with making films. I didn't have the confidence to involve other people in that process yet. I wanted to be totally solitary. And to just wait until I got it to a point where someone could look at it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas when you're making a film, a narrative fiction film, it's very collaborative from the very get-go. And there's a lot of different voices. And I just wanted to... So I used to do things like put food colouring on the... I tried to be a bit Len Lai, you know, this kind of thing. Tampering with the film and stuff like that. Just to see what effects I could get. Oh, but that was a very different thing to what I'm doing now.
Although the Devil's Doorway is kind of, is playing around with a kind of, it's kind of found footage type thing, isn't it? It's kind of a, so in a sense, that's still running through your process, is it?
And
in some way?
It is partly shot on 16mm film. So just because I'm comfortable with that form and also I can tell the difference. It's set in 1960. And if it's meant to be a found document, they would have used 16mm film. They wouldn't have been. And I can tell. And I think it's quite stark. So I did some test shoots with digital format. Producers never want to pay for something that they could do for free, essentially. So digital is essentially free compared to film.
Yes.
And but I did some test shoots and convinced them that it was worth spending money on. And it was a very small budget. It was low budget, you know.
Right. When you say a small budget, what's for the whole film? What are we talking? What's a small budget film? I mean, when I think, you know, I'm going to sit down and write a book, and it costs me the price of a new notebook and three pencils. Yes. So my idea of a budget is about is under 20 quid. If I keep it under that, then really I'm happy. What are you talking for?
So it was made. It was 230,000. That's considered to be ultra low budget.
Okay, right.
That's considered to be very cheap.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised at how much that money gets eaten up just with the amount of people that work on a film. You've got like 100 people doing various things and you've got catering every day and so on. So it gets eaten up really quickly.
Yeah. So you studied film at Queen's. Then, I've got my film degree. Good, you said to yourself.
Well, yes, I actually came to Queen's to study English because I thought I have to do something. I've got some kind of fighting chance of getting a job out of it. I'll be a teacher, you know.
Okay.
I would hate to be a teacher for like a school teacher. I don't think I'd be very good at that. But I thought that's what I would do. But I took film as an elective module and then I just loved it. So I threw all my eggs into that
basket.
Oh,
right. Okay. Right.
And did that. And then I was really lucky because when I was in my, and then I did masters in film and visual art here as well. And while I was doing that, UTV had this little scheme where they'd give you 500 quid to make a documentary. And I pitched a documentary to them. They gave me the money. I made that little doc and it won a prize and they showed it loads of times late at night and stuff. And did for years, you know, I still sometimes hear about it. But anyway, on the back of that, I got hired by a TV production company who had a commission to make a slate of 10 short documentaries for RTE. So I went and did that.
Right.
Straight out of university.
God,
so
that's
I was very,
fantastic.
Very
yeah, that
lucky.
Was, that worked well then, didn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
And then I ended up working in TV for a number of years and factual entertainment mostly. Ideas and researching and developing ideas for factual entertainment.
Just remind me exactly what factual entertainment is.
Game shows, reality TV, stuff
great.
Like that.
All the stuff I actually watch.
Well, I was actually pretty good at it, you know. And even though it's not, I don't watch that kind of stuff either. And I got offered a job at Channel 4 and I just thought, I don't really want to continue doing this because I'm going to get very comfortable and I'm not going to be able to leave and I'm going to feel stifled, you know, because the money is pretty good and it just gets better. And then you'd find that you're doing that forever.
Yes. So it's almost like a pact with the devil.
Yes. So I just decided to leave. It was really stressful as well.
Was it?
You know, you're working on some kids' TV show, but you're getting calls or, you know, in the middle of the night and stuff about things. And you're like, why would anybody have this amount of stress in their lives for like kids' TV show, you know? I just decided to leave and I went to New York to do a screenwriting diploma.
Right.
And
what was that like? It was
brilliant.
Was it? Right.
Yes, it was amazing.
Right.
I love New York.
Yeah.
And then did theatre stuff for a while, but I was still making visuals now and then, but I wasn't making narrative film really, although I was writing it. And then I decided to just focus in on that. So I made a number of shorts and then The Devil's Doorway come up and that's it.
Bloody hell. It's an amazing story, isn't it? So from the moment when you thought, oh, I've got a great idea for this thing, The Devil's Doorway, to the moment at which you're sitting in a cinema somewhere watching it yourself going, my goodness, that's my film. How long is that period of time? What's the...
Well, first of all, the initial idea for that wasn't mine. That was brought to me.
Right.
So the producer, he needed to have an Northern Irish director because that's the circumstance, like the funding, you have to have an Northern Irish director. So he spoke to a number of people, but his idea, there was no script or anything. His idea was he wanted to make a found footage film set in a Magdalen laundry, but it would all be modern, like now, contemporary. And there would be like spirits of girls who were there that would be, it'd be kind of like the Blair Witch Project, except it would be in a Magdalen, an abandoned Magdalen laundry.
Right.
And I just thought that it should be handled in a different way. I thought it could be problematic. You want to be very careful when you're talking about real life trauma that people have gone through and stuff like that, where you're kind of laying the... I don't think it should just be used for cheap thrills, basically. Mm. So I pitched the different approach, which is what we did, and he liked that, and that's how that happened. I think from that point, and then the funding and all happened pretty quick after that, and there was almost nothing of a development period. It was like from him saying that, and you know, I was having that first meeting and me saying, why wouldn't you do it like this, and him saying, I love that idea, let's do that, and then us getting the funding and then actually shooting the whole film was like 6 months.
Wow.
So there was no script or anything at that point, and it was very contracted period of, there wasn't really development, so to speak. It was just all like guns blazing, you know. And then, but the whole process took about a year and a half. Because then you've got, after that, you've got all your post-production to do. Then you don't have enough money to do certain things and you're waiting to, you know, all that. So between that and then actually coming out was about a year and a half.
Mm. And it's often what, because I'll be honest with you, I didn't go to see this because I can't go and see anything that is even close to horror. Because I always have a feeling that if it's, with a horror film, I'm always worried that it will somehow get inside me. Do you know what I mean? And I can't get it out then.
Yeah. I mean, I get really scared watching horror films. People think, oh, you make horror films, you know, you must be really brave or something, you know. But actually, I'm the biggest scaredy cat.
Oh, are you?
Going, yeah. I really freak myself out reading scary stories, watching horror films, and I have to put the light on, and, you know, The Exorcist still terrifies me to this day.
I think it's, as it terrifies many of us to this day.
Yes.
I think that's what put me on. I think
it, you know, it was that.
I think so, yeah.
The feeling that it'll change you in some way.
Yes, yeah. I think that's right, yeah.
I think most horror doesn't really have that effect, that, you know, it stays with you. Really, a lot of horror films are made just because they can be made quite cheaply and they can be very profitable. So there's kind of a glut of them that get made.
Oh, I see.
You've got a very loyal fan base there who kind of going to watch everything. So, but really good horror films are the ones that stick with you, I think. The ones that do get under your skin a little bit.
Yeah. And you can't then, extirpate them from your, you know, can't dig it out, can you? Can't.
Well, I feel like there's an element of, they're cathartic in a way, the films that are like that. Did you see Hereditary?
No.
Ari Aster's first feature film, actually, is a really brilliant director. It came out last year, I think. And it really made a massive splash in the horror scene. And I think you should watch it because it's a really good film.
But I'm definitely not going to watch it. Is it going to stay with me?
Stayed with me. And that's very rare that happens. Normally, I can. Horror films can be kind of fun because they have this logic and there's this order to them and everything gets resolved at the end and they can be comforting in that way. But,
and is that part of the appeal to you, do you think? Is that why you are drawn to... I mean, what is the appeal? Is that
I think a lot of people who like horror, that's why they like it. They might be kind of anxious people and there's something cathartic about them.
Oh, right.
Because so they
bizarrely
have that order.
Comforting in some way.
Yeah, in real life, when horrible stuff happens, it might seem like there's no logic to it. Things can happen in broad daylight that are terrifying, that are awful, and that ruin your whole life. But horror films have many horror films, but not the best ones, have this sort of order that comes full circle and everything is resolved. But if you have films like Hereditary or Don't Look Now, you're not given that escape valve of everything resolves. It feels more like the real life horror that doesn't.
Yeah. And do you prefer those to the...
Yeah.
Right.
And I couldn't tell you why. It does sound like there's a bit of... I like them all. I also like the ones that are... I don't like every horror film. Some of them are terrible. But I like the ones that are functional and kind of fun and that you're not expecting any deep, meaningful... You know, you're not expecting any resonance from it. But I really admire, and in a cinematic sense, the ones that go beyond that into something else that's truly horrifying.
Yeah.
To Plant a Garden, after Paul Grucha and Holly Beth Prince. I cannot remember the exact date on which my mother began teaching me to cook or grow vegetables and flowers well. But I remember the feeling of freshly turned soil against my knees with her in the backyard. And I remember standing on a creaky kitchen chair to marvel at my mother cracking an egg into a bowl without putting a single piece of shell out of place. This is like how I cannot remember the first time I made contact with water that had not come from a tap or a garden hose. But I can tell you the exact place where I waded into the Chippewa River up to my knees on a hot evening in June, watched the grasses and the willows sway, and became a constituent part of the whole organism.
Do you see yourself then having done... I mean, is this what you do now? Or kind of in genre terms, do you see yourself moving kind of into other arenas?
First of all, I would never just say that I'm a horror filmmaker because I think that'd be a weird thing to do. You know, it's like I gravitate towards dark stories, but I wouldn't just stick with the genre.
You get dark stories in any kind of genre.
In dramas and thrillers and everything else. I wouldn't pigeonhole myself like that. But... for me, the type of horror that I want to make isn't the formulaic type, even though sometimes those are fun to watch. I want to make the stuff that is a bit more transgressive, that blurs the boundaries a bit more, and that does kind of, that somehow clashes with expectation, you know? So to talk about it, and actually it feeds into what we're going to discuss today as well. We're talking about summer and... the summer solstice and things like that.
This is our solstice edition. Yes, you're quite right. Yes, thank you. Edition. Yes, good. Yes.
Ari Aster has a new film, who made Hereditary, has a new film coming out this summer that's called Midsummer. The Scandinavian spelling of that, the Swedish spelling. And it's 24-hour
Midsummer,
daylight.
Presumably. I don't know what Midsummer. Scandinavian... Is Midsummer. It right? Okay, fine.
Yeah. So it's set during the midsummer festivities and it's 24-hour daylight, you know. And I think there's some, and actually also it goes to the extent of having, you know, the way you have the black strap lines and a cinema screen. Do you know what I mean?
No, I'm pretending I know what you mean. Do you mean like the top and the bottom?
Like, you know, when you've got widescreen
formats.
I've got you.
Yes, okay, fine. The black bits.
His are white. So there's this like unrelenting brightness to it, which I find really unsettling in an appealing kind of a way, you know? When things, there's a comfort in, oh, it's, things are dark and spooky, or, you know, scary things happen at night. But taking that away and making it broad daylight, it's Sweden, rural Sweden. There's girls in nice white frocks and there's flowers everywhere. And
that, you're freaking me out
unrelenting
already.
Unrelenting daylight. I think there's something, I think it's creepier when it's, when you make things clash like that. Mm. So like something like The Wicker Man, I guess, as well.
Yeah. So you don't have to have darkness to have darkness, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it can be more disconcerting if you don't.
Yeah.
If you set it in a more, in a package that should be comforting or that should be safe.
Mm. Is it really weird that you know, where people, I know in literary terms, people, is there a kind of cinematic equivalent of the kind of weird, the weird, you know, the kind of, what that sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, HP, I think I do.
You know, that tradition of the
weird.
Well,
for example, I made a short film called Childer,
okay.
Which is online, you know, if you look it up. And the script that I wrote, it's essentially a story about a woman who, sorry, spoiler alert, a woman who kills her child.
Right.
And it could have been set in a gritty housing estate. It could have been set in suburbia. But I wanted to put it into this kind of fairy tale world, this pretty sort of gingerbread house. It's not real gingerbread, obviously. It's
That would have been fantastic.
It has that kind of air about it. It's this weird little house that I already knew about in the middle of the forest. And it's also daylight for most of the film. It's only ever twilight or daylight. And everything is neat and clean and it's kind of got this Wes Anderson-y kind of order to it. But it's a horror film. And for me, that makes it more affecting and more interesting than if you'd set the same story in a more expected environment. Because I guess it's like a fairy tale world. You've got the forest all around, the pretty house. There's like a little frog in it. Little frog.
That's a winner.
There's a cast of frog, yes. And but these terrible things happen because in reality, terrible things infiltrate life everywhere. There's nowhere that's safe. And because it is a child that gets killed in the film, it's, you know, upsetting that order, I guess.
Fourth of July outside Milan, Minnesota. Your father's junkyard glistened in the distance as it drizzled on our grill out. All nine of us clambered into the two-bed camper when it started to hail. We watched your father transform from patriot to farmer. Your mother ran to the rhubarb and sour cream cake left in the storm. Your father longed to bring in the acres of corn stalks still shedding their baby teeth in the fields. Their leaves cannot be pieced together, patched like your father's coveralls with scraps from the hamper of worn-out jeans in the basement. The cattle cannot live on out-of-service combines and picked over antique tractor parts, and we cannot venture into the hail.
Oh, you were telling me about this thing you went to in Luxembourg.
Mm-hmm. I was at this like producers conference type thing. I'm not a producer, obviously, but I was invited by my producer to go to this conference and we went there for a week. The hotel is in the middle of an industrial estate. I mean, like you're literally miles away from anything that isn't just very clean and ordered and...
This sounds like a perfect setting for it, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it was very odd. And we're in this very modern hotel that was very expensive, but thankfully we didn't have to pay for it. And
best kind of hotel.
Everything was very modern and clean, but totally without soul, I felt. Mm. But
the opposite of my office.
Exactly. But anyway, one of the other guys that was there, people from all over Europe, but one of the other guys was Irish as well. And he went out for a run one day and came back and said, I found this big wooden structure, you know, like a wicker man type thing, just in the middle of the countryside over there. And I saw some people passing by and I said, what is this? And they said, oh, we do this ritual every year. We're doing it tomorrow night. And he was like, what's it for? And they said, we don't remember. We've done it always. It's just a thing that we do.
Right.
And so naturally,
it really is like the Wicker Man, isn't it?
Yes. We have to go to that. So the next night we trekked down there. It was like a 2 mile walk away, I think. And watched them burn this huge structure that nobody could remember why they do it anymore.
And what did it look like, the structure? What was it?
It's very difficult to kind of express. It was a wooden frame thing, quite complicated. It didn't look like a person. I couldn't tell you what shape it was meant to be. It was just this
Luxembourgian shaped
thing.
Right, okay.
And it was quite bizarre because they were playing Europop and stuff.
Europop. What, like, I'm trying to think of, but
you know, like Aqua, I'm a Barbie Girl.
Oh, right,
like
okay.
That. You know, it was like that, so kind of music, you know.
Stuff is burning.
Aqua, and then they set the thing Barbie on fire is, at some point. Playing. And it was really incredible. Like, it was because it's very dark. We're in the middle of nowhere, so there's no street light or anything. And then they set this thing aflame, and it's like the whole fields all around, but it looks like a weird broad daylight.
Okay.
All around. It was bizarre, and yeah.
Are people hollering and shouting, or are they kind of silently?
Yeah, people cheered and stuff.
Cheered, okay.
There was no like dancing around or any other like ritual aspect that I saw. But
okay, are there hot dog vans and that?
Yes,
sort of
there
stuff?
Were hot dog vans.
I don't know. I find that reassuring.
It was
some
very
way.
Civilized,
right?
You know,
okay.
When you went in, you bought tokens. They give you this thing of tokens, and you used your tokens to buy like hot dogs and beer and stuff. But it was all very family friendly and civilized. And
The family friendly ritual burning
but
of
nobody
stuff
knows
is
what it's for,
right?
So strange.
That's like most rituals, though, isn't it? Presumably, none of us know what any of it's for. Anyway, I'm trying to think. There's a rabbinic story, isn't there, about, you know, where the rabbi goes, and you know, we go into the field and we say this kind of prayer, and we perform these rituals. And then the next year, they've forgotten what the prayer is, but they still go to the field and they still perform some sort of ritual. And the year after that, they go back and they can no one can remember any more, either the prayers or what the ritual is, but we keep doing it anyway.
It's kind of like that story about the monkeys. I don't know if you know this one,
no, go
about
on.
This experiment that was done over a number of years. You've got a group of monkeys and there's a banana over here. I might be remembering this slightly wrong, but something like this. There's a banana over here. A monkey goes for it, and then everybody gets rained on. They like rain. They shower water down from the ceiling. So then those monkeys learn, we don't touch that banana. When we do that, it rains. And then slowly they replace every monkey with a new monkey until eventually there are no monkeys in the room who ever knew about the rain, but they still don't touch the banana.
Okay.
Because they've inherited this from the previous monkeys.
Yes. Wow.
That something bad will happen, but they don't know what.
The monkeys and the rain and the bananas.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, it makes absolute total sense.
So somewhere in the mists of time, maybe, you know, the crops failed or something, and these Luxembourgian people developed this ritual that was in some kind of offering or something. But at this point, it's all been forgotten, but they still do it because they feel that something bad will happen if they don't.
Yeah. Ritual-wise, do you have similar things when you're writing, when you're doing, you know, when you're doing your work? Do you think, if I do it in the, I mean, I'm suggesting now that writing might be a form of kind of ritual behavior as well, I suppose. Do you have a kind of process that you have to go through in order to do what you're doing? Does it have that?
Yeah, I know some people who work like that.
Mm.
I don't really.
No.
I like to, Jimmy McAlevey's a bit like this as well. I like to be like sort of lying down, be that, you know, legs up on the couch
or
sometimes I write in bed. I don't know why that is. And that's become a habit.
Is that because you're trying to kid yourself that you're not really doing it? Is that part of it?
Maybe it is. I just don't anymore write sitting at, like if I'm actually writing.
Do you not? You don't?
Sitting at a desk. No. And Jimmy does the same thing. I don't know, maybe it is that you're trying to kid yourself that it's, that you're not really working or something.
See, that's very, because I have the opposite. I increasingly write standing up.
Do you?
Yeah, I've kind of changed my.
Do you use a pen and a pad, or?
I'd use a pen and a piece. Yeah, well, pencil and a piece of paper and a notebook. But with me, I think the reason I do that is partly because what I'm doing is I'm having to tell myself that I am doing something, that I have to do it, rather than kidding myself that I'm not doing it. You know, it's just what I mean.
Yes.
It's a kind of...
I think also, you know, there's a slightly different process. So when I'm writing, I think actually the most of the writing I do is working the story out and all that kind of stuff. I do that when I'm walking the dog. You know, I do that when I'm on a train. When I say that I'm writing, I'm really transcribing.
Oh, I see.
Into script format.
Okay, you know? Right.
So I guess that part of the job, I've already done all of the story. I know what that is. So a lot of that I would take notes when I'm walking around or, you know, sitting on a train. But somehow I don't think of that as writing. But of course, that's the vast majority of the writing. Whereas when I open a final draft and I'm typing it in, that's writing.
Yeah. And is that unique to you when you're writing scripts? If you're writing prose, for example, you may quietly, as so many of us are, you may quietly be a poet as well. I've no idea. But if you're writing prose, for example, would you go about it in the same way? Or
I actually had a poem published when I was,
when I was there we are.
Like 19 or 20. I haven't written a poem since.
Right.
I don't know what that's all about. But
well, if you peek. I've got
into this Chatterton, small collection of Northern Irish poems, going anywhere. Mm. Yeah. I used to write prose a bit more, and I am writing a story at the minute for Swan River Press in Dublin.
Right.
For their collection coming out like next year, I think.
Have you kept the prose going alongside?
Not really.
No.
No, I feel very out of practice with that kind of side of things, actually. One of the reasons why I agreed to do it was to kind of get back into it a bit. I don't know, like when I'm walking the dog, that's when most of it happens. And my husband, we're walking the dog together, and then we can talk about it. And I could say, oh, well, I've got this idea or that idea, you know. But if you're writing prose, I think you're much more inventing as you're writing as well. Because screenplays are not really about... They're much more a functional document. They're a blueprint to make a film, whereas the prose is the thing in itself, and so is the poem.
Yeah.
So when you're writing prose, you know what the story is, but you also are thinking about language more.
Yeah.
A screenplay is just delivering plot.
Yeah.
You can write it. You can write it beautifully, and some people write it better than others. But essentially, it's functional rather than something that's meant to be read for pleasure.
Can I ask about the dog then? Because if you didn't have a dog, what would you have to get another dog?
I'd have to have a dog.
I mean, the dog would be...
Dog's a central part of everything. Couldn't write a word without the dog.
Yeah. On that dog-loving high note, should we... I think we should maybe say thank you very much for... Unless you've got any other... Have you got either any dog or solstice or kind of writing advice that you'd like to impart? Yeah,
finish it. Just write it and actually do it, you know.
Right.
Finish the thing.
Yeah.
That's the best advice that you can give.
Just finish it.
Yes.
Okay. Well, probably best if we do.
The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is created in a small back room by Ian Sanson, Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown, with thanks to producers Chantal Aylesby and Toby James, and to Nick Boyle for his music.